Welcome to Sport Faith Life with Brian Bolt and Chad Carlson, two guys who came together for one common purpose, to think deeply about sport and faith. They are sports scholars, they're coaches, and they're competitive athletes, or at least they were. And together, they've created Sport Faith Life, a conversation that meets at the intersection of sport and faith.
Today on Sport Faith Life, we speak with Luke Helm. Luke's an interesting guy. He's coached two nationally ranked collegiate tennis programs. He's an author with graduate degrees in both theology and writing. He's won a pickleball national championship. And I know him as the director of rackets at the oldest country club in the state of Michigan, one that I certainly can't afford. We can't wait to dig into all of this and so much more. So, let's get started.
We're so excited to have Luke Helm with us today. Luke, tell us a little bit about sport in your life.
Yeah, sport has been always in the backdrop for me and for my family. Grew up in a very enthusiastic sports family. Grew up playing everything from soccer, baseball, basketball, tennis eventually, but everybody was playing something pretty much every season, and had a great time with junior sports and lived much of my early childhood at some sort of athletic field. And it was always kind of there alongside everything else we had going on, and grew up playing soccer a ton. And then added in kind of everything else along the way. And then it was in, I think I was nine. So the story goes, the received story is at nine, our next door neighbor borrowed my mom's wooden racket, left it behind his mom's car. She backed over it and it came back at a 90 degree angle. Then he had to go buy us a new one. And when he bought the new one, instead of a wooden racket, it was, the, you know, 1992 bright orange, bright green, Andre Agassi something or other, to which my brother and I thought, well, this is awesome. Whatever this thing is, we want to do this. So my mom signed us up for a free, junior league tennis camp, and, my brother, my sister, and I all ended up playing college tennis. So that is the received story. The timeline of that somehow has gotten weird over the years. We're not entirely sure how that plays out and how that timeline works with some of the other things that we had going on. But for as many times as I told that story, I think I've got to stick with it at this point. But that's how we got introduced to the sport of tennis. And then that kind of stuck. We all played college tennis. And then after some grad school or during grad school, I ended up getting a job at a tennis club across the street from the first grad program that I was a part of. And I kept thinking that I was going to be done with tennis soon. And it just keeps following me wherever I go. So the sport element, it has really been a through line throughout my life. Tennis has been a huge part of my adulthood as well. I became a college tennis coach too, and spent a lot of years doing that, and then am now the director of rackets at a country club here in Grand Rapids. And it has been an ongoing theme throughout my life, and continues to be something that I'm passionate about and interested in, but it's always been there as a part of my life. So it's certainly played a large role in really every chapter of my life at this point.
Despite what Brian might say, I think tennis is the ultimate lifelong sport, Luke. So I'm with you. I'm with you there. But hey, tell us a little bit about faith in your life now.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways you could probably say that faith and sport were really the two through lines of my life. Faith was also always there, always operating in my life. Very much was the water I swam in. Grew up at a church school for elementary school, and our church was the location. So I was there 6 days a week or seven, depending on how many church sports I was playing. So it was, faith was always, kind of ever present in my life as well. I grew up in the youth group and very involved in the world of faith. And I always kind of, gravitated to the world of faith is a frequency that seems to be something that I've always just kind of been in tune with. And again, at every stage of my life, that has been, whether it's me wanting to do school to understand faith more, or, putting myself through, the challenge of trying to figure out how much of my faith still made sense to me, or being involved, with, my church today, there, it's always been there as well. So I think faith and sport have kind of been the two twin pillars of my existence at this point.
So that intersection, I think, is going to be helpful for us as we get into our next conversation. But I'm wondering if there's one thing, Luke, that our audience might learn about you to help us get to know you a little bit, some hobby activity, near-death experience, all that kind of fun stuff.
Yeah, so I was forewarned that this question would be included during our chat. And the story that came to mind was the story of I received a call from my brother. It was after I graduated from college, and I was living in Indianapolis, where I'm from. And I got a call from my brother, and his introduction to his plan was, you need to pack up your car today, drive to Florida tonight, and we're headed to Nicaragua tomorrow to play semi-professional softball. So I packed up my car. I drove overnight. I got to Florida the next day. I hopped out of the car, jumped in his. We drove to Miami, caught a flight to Nicaragua, where we proceeded to learn that we were not prepared for semi-professional softball in Nicaragua over the course of about probably 10 days that we played almost a triple header a day, driving in a school bus throughout the country, learning that tennis players from Indiana were not prepared to play fast pitch softball. But we had a great time doing it. And then made our way back to Florida eventually, where, I kind of recovered from the whiplash of, what seemed like a great idea.
Well, for what it's worth, Luke, I'm in. So if you give me that call, I'm ready to go. You had me at fast pitch softball, which is for men, it's just few and far between opportunities. So I used to play way back when. I'm a little older now, but let's go. Chad, you can come along. That's fine. I think Nicaragua sounds great.
I would love that.
Seems like a good experience.
Yeah, they were way closer to us than we thought they were going to be when the ball was coming out of their hand.
Yeah, that's the thing about softball, right? That it's a much closer pitching mound than baseball, and man, it's frightening. It's moving. Rise ball is moving. A totally different thing.
Yeah, yes, that is different.
Yes, the ball goes up. That's very strange. Gravity, it doesn't make any sense. Yeah, so a great experience, one that maybe some of your tennis background could have prepared you for, just the speed of the ball coming at you. But in many ways, a totally new one. Another thing that would maybe be unexpected is that even though you've spent a lot of time coaching, you spent some time working as a club professional, you've gotten into writing. And in some ways, writing about sport has become an outlet for you. And this is how we as Sport Faith Life kind of discovered you. You had a piece in Christian Century where you talked a little bit about the big three. And in this case, if you follow professional tennis, the big three is known to just about everybody that follows: Nadal, Federer, Djokovic, this end of an era. And so I wonder what I thought was, there was a lot of intriguing things about that story. First of all, it was a fun read. I felt myself sort of being sucked into it, which well done. But you're also trying to make a point there about story. And I wonder if we could start there. It says at the top of this article, humans crave stories that create order. Get us underneath that. What are you talking about?
Yeah, the realization that I had as I was writing it really came out of my first thesis of my master's degree in my first grad program. And I studied some literary theorists who had convictions about the role that stories play in making our lives meaningful. And the way that that came out in the thesis that I was working on was looking at the idea that order is provided by stories. So the beginning, the middle, and the end is kind of the definition of what a story is. And it was actually Augustine who talked about the idea that stories create order and concordance. So from discordance, they create concordance. And the idea there is that you are taking things that seem random and you are putting them together in a way that you make it into a whole. And in the process of doing that, you create meaning and you create something that's cohesive and coherent out of something that previously seemed either unrelated or loosely related. And so in storytelling, you are creating meaning out of disparate parts. And as I was working on that thesis, you know, I loved Djokovic, Federer, Nadal, and watching the battles between them, but I was not yet at a point where I saw the connection between them. But it was really coming out of watching Djokovic lose that US Open final that I described in the end of the piece, where I was sitting there and I just thought, man, I feel so conflicted about watching him lose this. And I was a Federer aficionado and I came to love Nadal just because of the foil that he became to Federer and the bond that they shared and the matches that they played. And I'm watching Djokovic just feeling so conflicted. And I really felt like, what is this feeling that I'm experiencing? And I didn't really have a way to name it. And so writing the article was really my way to try to get to the bottom of what is this thing that I feel. I want him to break the record because it's a part of history, but I don't want to see the record broken. And I want to believe that Federer is going to come back and he's going to, you know, become the greatest ever again. But knowing that time was against him and, you know, the injuries that he was, you know, going to be tasked with overcoming to come back, it just looked like the writing was on the wall. So it really was that sense of trying to pair very unlike things in the work that I'd done in that master's thesis with this sense of like, how do I make sense out of this story that doesn't make sense? And an effort to do that, that really felt imperfect all the way through. But that's what the story became, was kind of my attempt to make order out of disorder. And it was really that disorder that I was feeling that kind of prompted all this.
So I wonder if we can get your perspective on these three tennis gods, right, that you're making sense of being a tennis guy. How do you see each of them? And certainly, because of their wins, of course, they're seen as gods in tennis, right? And you're making sense of this story in your own mind. But also, like, start there. Just give us a sense of how you see each of those three.
Yeah, so Federer rewrote the book on what it meant to be great. You know, Sampras had 14 Grand Slams, and everybody said, well, no one's ever going to get 14. And then Federer, in this string of years, all of a sudden reels off enough to where everybody says, oh wow, he's not only gonna get there, he's gonna exceed that. And then all of a sudden Nadal shows up on the scene as like the perfect foil. You know, Federer's right-handed, Nadal's left-handed. You know, Federer hits this perfect one-handed backhand, but Nadal's left-handed forehand is the perfect a foil, or if you were going to craft a person to disrupt Federer's game, it would be Nadal. And so you have this like perfect pre-written story, what it seemed like between the two of them. And Nadal just consistently just became a greater and greater champion over the years. And he moved from being just a clay guy to all of a sudden he was formidable on hard courts. And then all of a sudden he was decent on grass, and then he was good on grass. And then, you know, you watch this rise where all of a sudden Nadal is inserting himself into the mix where he never should have, based on being from Spain and having that, you know, his game was crafted on clay courts. And yet he just kept getting better, kept getting better. So you have that kind of, you know, built-in rivalry. And then all kind of out of left field, all of a sudden you have this guy from Serbia showing up, and he was so inconvenient, you know, in the way that he came in and started disrupting that story of Federer and Nadal. And that, to me, he, you know, there is no question that the rivalry that existed between Federer and Nadal, Djokovic had no choice but to surpass all expectations in order to make himself relevant. Because they had pushed each other so far that by the time he was trying to break in and move his way up the world rankings and start winning those big titles, the level that he achieved was really unthinkable. And then the three of them together just kept the careers just kept going and going and going. And so the stories kept going and going and going. You know, the back and forth between them over the years was also just unthinkable. You know, I remember Agassi retiring, I think at 36, maybe he was 34, and everybody thinking, oh my gosh, he's ancient. I can't believe he lasted this long. And then now you have, you know, Federer at 36, 37, 38 being dominant, and then Nadal doing the same thing, and then Djokovic doing even better than either of them. So it became this thing where all three of them just kept rewriting the book as to what was possible in the sport and competitively. But the three of them just occupied such distinct roles within that three-way rivalry that, you know, anyone who's followed tennis at all, you know, they're just kind of prefabricated for those different spots within that three-way rivalry.
You know, I this won't be a popular opinion, but when I'm watching Star Wars, I kind of root for Darth Vader. And, you know, Professor Snape was my favorite character in Harry Potter. I rooted for Djokovic. I was one of the very few, I think, that just loved the bad boy element of Djokovic. I thought, Federer is so elegant and such a pretty boy. And the grit of Nadal, you know, and just the boyish good looks and all of that. And here comes Djokovic. And nobody likes him. And for a career, everybody roots against him. And he totally destroys the story. And I get a little bit of, you know, pleasure out of that. I don't know why. I love the fact that he destroys the stories. And you write about sport. Sometimes stories end in ways that frustrate and confuse us. And that feels like the end of every season I've ever played or coached. Tell me more about that statement.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is that as I finished this story, I never felt satisfied with the way that the story in the Christian Century ended. And I think that's kind of built into it, is that it was a unsatisfying ending. And I mean, I think at the end of the day, there's so much of us that wants the storybook ending, and you know the work that you've put in, you know the feeling of desiring to see your guy win, and it does happen so rarely that is the way that it ends. And you know, tennis, I tell people this all the time, but part of what makes tennis brilliant and brutal is the fact that if you have 16 guys that come together for a tournament on a weekend, 15 of them are going home losers. and the ability to make your peace with losing and making your peace with the story not ending the way that you want it to is such a lesson that is needed, and such a lesson that forces us to grow and forces us to make our peace with the ways in which stories frustrate and confuse us. And in that section that you read, you know, in the story, I'm talking to my 4-year-old son, because he did, when that match was ending, he kind of crawled into my lap, and I then found myself trying to explain to him this weird, complex emotion that I'm feeling about watching Djokovic, you know, go for this record. And you know, I find myself doing the same thing as a coach, you know, especially when I was a college coach, and we would put all the time and effort into a season and then to have heartbreak, or to, you know, we got to experience some triumphs too, but you know, the triumph is the exception to the rule. And you know, trying to convey that to the guys who poured their hearts out, the fact that that process is worthwhile. You know, I found that that came to mean a lot to me, to see the ways that it shaped them, despite the pain that we went through when things didn't go our way.
It seems like there's something spiritual, or there can be something spiritual about so many different sports in the same way, right? That we are doing things together and we experience success or failure, oftentimes in groups, right? And there's shared pain there, and we grow from that. And there's all these lessons that can be learned from sport. I'm curious, from your perspective, if you think there's anything unique about tennis and what that might be. You know, baseball might be God's sport because there's sacrifices, and we quantify sacrifices, right? Or Brian and I have talked about others like soccer, lacrosse. There's a goalkeeper, right? There's somebody that saves, right? And those are a little bit tongue in cheek and a little bit shallow. What do you see in tennis that evokes the spiritual? And is there anything unique to that sport?
I mean, you're teeing me up here because I'm batting for the home team when it comes to tennis and all of the ways in which there's all kinds of meaning packed into it. But I feel very committed to the idea that tennis is an engine for personal growth, and tennis is an engine for learning. And really, I think one of the biggest things is the one's relationship to yourself gets tested in tennis in a very specific way. And I don't think golf is far behind, because you have the same sense of being alone with yourself, not being able to point at anybody else. You know, I call tennis a fishbowl sport because when you're playing, you feel like everyone's watching you, regardless of whether anyone is. That sense of, you know, not being able to turn and point at anybody else when things go sideways and having to deal with that. I think there's a lot there. I think too, the kind of mano a mano element of tennis is something that I think is really unique to it. You know, I don't know anything about boxing, but I've always felt like there's a similar spirit to it, where that mano a mano element becomes either a source of bitterness and contention, but it also, in the case of Federer and Nadal, you know, you see this incredible bond that's formed by the fact that the two of them forced each other to get better and better and better. And you know, in the inner game of tennis, Stephen Galway talks about the idea that there's another way of conceiving of competition, that you're really aiming for mutual betterment, and the better I get, the better it forces you to get. And I really think tennis at its best becomes an engine for that it forces you to recognize, you know, honestly, and with clear eyes, what ways in which did I fail, and in what ways did you just outperform me? And that framework is something that I think is enormously valuable, to people in tennis, but then also in life, learning to recognize the ways in which Competition doesn't necessarily need to be contentious. It can also be something that produces respect for the people that you're competing against.
Well, I think that's a great ending, fitting ending to this conversation, but really it's just a start. I know that this piece that you wrote also digs into this idea of story and the truth of that story, and how a biblical stories give us a sense of order in this place where we wonder about truth and trying to get at who are we and what is our purpose in this world, something that we like to explore here at Sport Faith Life. Luke, thanks so much for spending a little time with us here to tell us a little bit. If folks wanted to find your article, where would they find it?
Yeah, you can find that article at Christian Century. Believe it's christiancentury.com. You can also find it just linked through my website, lukeahelm.com as well.
Awesome. Great. Thanks. Keep writing, Luke. That was fantastic. I love to see the intersection of the way that you think about sport and the way that you think about faith. And we're really excited to get to know you in this process. So thanks very much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the Sport Faith Life podcast, a conversation at the intersection of sport and faith. Read the corresponding blog post and learn more about us at sportfaithlife.com. Listen to more of our podcasts on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and follow us on social media to stay up to date with everything sport, faith, life.